Welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. That is the giggly Hall of Famer, Chris Carter, who's in a very good mood. Nick Wright is in a good mood, even though your Chiefs are playing this weekend. You're a little nervous?
Not nervous at all. I'm just an impartial analyst.
Do you want to watch the game at Chris's house with a bunch of other people?
I got my kids. I have my kids every weekend, by the way, but my wife's out of town. I am the only person responsible for my kids this weekend.
You and Jenna are the only people that I know. What are you doing this weekend? I'm babysitting. What, babysitting?
Both of our wives are out of town.
Right, both our wives are out of town, and we, listen, man, don't, you mind your household.
It's going down, baby. Soon.
All right, let's talk some football. That is square on everyone's mind this morning as we get ready for the weekend. We are quickly approaching Championship Sunday, and for the Patriots, this will feel different. Not the game, but the odds. Patriots at Arrowhead to face the Chiefs. Get this, Pats will be playoff underdogs for the first time since the 2013 AFC Championship game. Break out the dog masks. Julian Edelman is certainly embracing the underdog role, tweeting out a hype video with the hashtag #BetAgainstUs. Here's what Brady had to say on not being favored come this Sunday.
Doesn't change much for us, but it just, you know, shows you kind of what, you know, people would think about, you know, what our chances are. That's about it.
Doesn't.
No more added comment to that.
See, come on. The Patriots can't really, truly, truly think they're underdogs in this.
Well, Jenna, you know you've been around sports for a long, long time, that it's one of the best tools that players, coaches will always use trying to create that type of edge. We saw it even as recent as last year. The underdog, the Philadelphia Eagles, the mask, everything. Yeah, they totally embraced it. And now we've had one of the greatest franchises that now all of a sudden, because they're not as talented, they got blown out on the road several times, that now they're getting ready to embrace. Because Bill Belichick does a great job of every week some type of way creating an edge in New England. That's how you're able to be consistent. So this is not the first time that New England and as an organization or coaching staff is going to take advantage of, say, you know, we're going to be the underdog. They create that every week. That's the way he coaches. That's why he really critiques the film and breaks down the Patriots. That's why they always say, if we don't play our best, we will lose. They always have that added incentive. Now they really have incentive because this is a young, up-and-coming team in the Kansas City Chiefs. They don't particularly match up well with them. They don't play well on the road, especially in AFC championship games. So, yes, it is set up. They should be an underdog. Kansas City has played a lot better football than the New England Patriots, and they should have home field advantage. So those are some of the perks. But now, as a world champion multiple times, very seldom are you ever going to see it. Yes, they get to use one of the greatest motivators that's ever been in sports is, oh, lack of respect, or yes, or we are the underdog.
I thought I would never see a more ridiculous version of nobody believes in us than around a decade ago when the men's Team USA basketball team was trying to play that card during the Olympics. Like, really? Really? But then Brady got this train started. He didn't come off the field against the Chargers like, hey, I know a lot of you analysts on TV picked against us. We're still alive. It was, I know we suck and we can't win any games. And now Julian Edelman, it's not only releasing a hype video, which, by the way, evidently I contributed to with some of my commentary on the Chiefs. No problem, Julian. Glad to help you sell some of your merchandise. He's selling T-shirts that bet against us. And Julian Edelman, by the way, I didn't know. You can buy a Julian Edelman skateboard on this website, a Julian Edelman onesie. I didn't know he had this whole budding empire, but that's neither here nor there. Just a little level set on the Patriots. They have been favored leading into this week in 67 consecutive games that Tom Brady started. Since the undefeated 07 team, they have played 24 playoff games. They were favored in 23 of those playoff games. So what has happened this year? It's very simple what has happened. They played in their first playoff game, a team with a better record, a team that was coming off a great performance. Mm-hmm. They had looked shaky, and I would say a third of the national media picked them to lose. And for the Patriots, That is as if we all said they're the Jets now.
Right.
That they, you know what I mean? Wait, hold on. It wasn't 1-10 that said we could lose. It was 1-3. They had their worst regular season they've had in a decade. Brady went from the MVP of the league to a fringe Pro Bowler. And so people analyze that as such. It doesn't make them the bad news bears as they are
of
presenting
course.
Themselves.
Why do you think they are underdogs in this game? Let's just break down what it is. You said that these two teams don't match up well. Why are they underdogs?
They don't have the ability, New England, to be able to throw the ball deep down the field. They don't have guys outside to be able to dominate. They don't have the overall team speed. Their linebacking core is not very good in pass coverage. They don't have a dominant pass rush. They probably have the worst defensive front of all the four
they
teams.
They are the Jets.
No, but their secondary is probably the best. So there are problems with how they play. Lack of big plays down the field. There's a reason why they're leaning on Sony Michel and that offensive line. There's a reason why they're playing James Devlin more than he's played any other time in his career. There's a reason why they have Gronk in the backfield as a lead blocker, because they even realize at this point that they are talent challenged on the offensive side, and they have to slow the game down and play this style for which they probably won their first three Super Bowls. And there's nothing wrong with it, but the only reason why you play this style is because this is your strength, compared to what their strength used to be, and that was throwing the football, throwing it 40 times
and
a game.
All that's true, but with all that being the case, if this game were in Gillette, they'd be the three-point favorite. They are the underdog because...
Well, actually, if Kansas City is a three-point favorite, mm-hmm. right, Nick?
Yes.
That means Vegas thinks it's an even game.
It's an even matchup. And so that's why if it were in Gillette...
So Vegas is giving New England
is saying they're
a tremendous
the
same. Amount
tremendous
of credit.
A tremendous amount of respect.
Yes.
Like, does anyone think that it would be legitimate for the Rams to come out with this week? Nobody believes in us. Everyone thinks we suck. Because they're 3.5-point underdogs. Here's why.
Right. After a 13-3.
After
right.
a 13-3 season.
Yes.
Here's the biggest reason why they're underdogs. The last 10 AFC and NFC championship games have been won by the home team. You have to go back all the way to 2012 for a road team to have won one of these games. The Patriots, in the last 5 years leading up to this, have won three of these games. They've lost two. They have won the three they were at home. They have lost the two they were on the road. Like, that's what this is about. This
also, it's a microcosm of this season because they cannot win. They just have such a poor time winning on the road in general.
Which is why a few years ago, they were actually favored in Denver in an AFC championship game. Now, they lost it. That was the two-point conversion game.
Wow.
The one they lost 2018 to the pending Super Bowl champion Denver Broncos. But the Patriots are supposed to be underdogs here. They are not. You know when nobody believed in the Patriots? When they were 10-point underdogs to the Pittsburgh Steelers in the AFC Championship game in 2001, and then 14-point underdogs to the St. Louis Rams, pardon me, in the Super Bowl. That's when nobody believed in them. That's when you really were this unbelievable underdog story. You are the greatest dynasty, arguably, in the history of sports, with the greatest coach and the greatest quarterback, and you just came off a game. You were up 35-7 at the half. Playing this card, I understand the motivational factor. I wonder how much they actually believe it, or I wonder how much it is the feeling of, wait, if you're the Patriots, is not being the overwhelming favorite, does that feel disrespectful? Because I think that's what we're seeing. I think they're like, wait, you guys actually think that it's a 60% chance we lose rather than an 80% chance we win? That's what feels different to them this time around.
Wow. New England Patriots, 5 Super Bowl wins since 2001, and they are not the favorites this weekend. Mm. We'll talk much more about this coming up. Why did Kyrie call LeBron James? Like, why did he just pick up the phone and call him? What did he have to say? We hear from him next on First Things First.
You know what, LeBron?
To the Celtics. Kyrie Irving did good things on the basketball court last night. His passes were good, his shots went in, and his team won. 27 points and a career-high 18 assists in a win over the Toronto Raptors. Celtics have been in a bit of a turmoil lately after Kyrie called out the team's young players. Not easy being a leader of men. Kyrie learned this the hard way and turned to an unlikely source for advice.
It was a big deal for me because I had to call Bron, you know, and tell him, like, you know, I apologize for being that young player that wanted to everything at his, you know, at his fingertips, and I wanted everything to be at you know, my threshold. I wanted to be the guy that led us to championship. I wanted to be the leader. I wanted to be all that. And, you know, the responsibility of being the best player in the world and leading a team is something that's not meant for many people. And Bron was one of those guys that came to Cleveland and tried to really show us what it's like to win a championship. And it was hard for him. And sometimes getting the most out of the group, it's not the easiest thing in the world. And like I said, only few are meant for it or chosen for it. And, you know, I feel like the best person to call was him because, you know, he's been in this situation. You know, he's been there with me where I've been the young guy of, you know, being a 22-year-old kid and, you know, wanting everything. Wanting everything right now. You know, coming off an all-star year starting and then, you know, this heck of a presence comes back and now I got to adjust my game to this guy. And, you know, you take it personal, but at the end of the day, he just wants what's best. And he has a legacy he wants to leave, and he has a window he wants to capture. So I think what that brought me back to is like, all right, how do I get the best out of this group of the success they had last year? And then helping them realize what it takes to win a championship.
So a lot there out of Kyrie. What did you make of what he had to say, Nick?
Good for Kyrie Irving, man. This is like the next step in his evolution as a player, evolution as a leader. Forget what he did on the court, which was one of the best regular season games of his career. Like, who they were playing, the fact that his team was in a slump, there was turmoil, and he had a career-high 18 assists. But that takes us backseat to what happened after the game, which is him recognizing being a great player is only part of the equation of being the leader on a championship team. And recognizing that what I thought I knew, I didn't actually know. What I thought was wrong actually might have been right. I just wasn't ready to accept it. And so I didn't see these comments until this morning. I saw the game last night, but I didn't see these. I woke up to these comments. And they were actually sent to me. They texted to me. And I saw it, and I was like, wow. Like, that is evolution from a player who we all know how talented he is. And it struck me by total surprise, and I give him enormous credit for taking that step and not only reaching out to LeBron, but then telling the world about it, yeah. Which he did not have to do.
Yeah, you got to give Kyrie Irving credit for one, for reaching out to LeBron. Number two, being able to share that information. But the truth of the matter is, he's still not out of the woods because to me, he's still very, very naive about what it takes to be a great leader. And at what point, besides high school, has he been a great leader?
Right.
All right? Played a partial season there at Duke. He was basically 1 foot in college basketball, 1 foot in the NBA already. He went to Cleveland. They were horrible. He was not a leader there. Just because you're the best player, just because you're the most talented, that does not make you a leader. And even him right now, the stage he's at, yeah, he did a great job apologizing. But that doesn't mean he's the leader of the Celtics. Like, that doesn't mean just because he apologized. Like, he still got a lot to be able to learn. Last night, it was a tremendous game because he was able to score and distribute the basketball. But I still believe that there's going to be problems there in Boston. Last year, a lot of people had Brad Stevens as the second best coach in the NBA. And I said, okay. All right, I don't believe you because I haven't seen enough, and I want to see him when he has a talented NBA team, not a team like Butler, because that's what the Celtics have been, and that's when he's gotten his best work out of teams that didn't have the big stars and role players. So for me, I still believe Kyrie Irving has a lot to learn as far as being a leader, because being a leader has a lot to do with, are you going to be the first guy there? Are you going to be the last guy to leave? Are you going to take care of your body and eat the way that you're trying to tell everyone to be able to maximize their performance? Because all those things play a role in being a leader in an NBA locker room.
Listen, I fully agree with you on as far as the Celtics and Kyrie not being out of the woods. I have been skeptical of this team within the Eastern Conference all year long, and one great win over Toronto after three bad losses doesn't solve that. But this is, to me, a first and necessary step. Now, I do know, like I said before the show, I said, you probably shouldn't have to give birth to know it's painful. You shouldn't necessarily have to live an experience to be able to relate to it. But you said, you don't know what you don't know. And like Kyrie is now, and I know that's an old, it's a tautology, it's an old axiom, but it's true. Like sometimes you think things shouldn't be this way, and then you live them yourselves and you realize they are. The Celtics do have a lot of work to do. But Kyrie's got to be the leader of that team because Tatum and Brown aren't ready. I don't think Horford is.
That's the problem. When you get into this appointment based on salary, you get in this appointment based on skill compared to who really are the leaders. A lot of times people, they don't want to give LeBron, but LeBron recruited guys that were their own leaders in their own way. Ray Allen was a sure. leader. Cal Corbett, they were leaders in everything. So you have to know how to bring leadership out in other people. You have to know how to empower other people. So there's a lot that I need to be able to see.
But let me ask you, because in your experience with team sports, isn't the ideal situation that your best leaders double as your best players? Maybe not one for one, but aren't the best teams typically where the best leader on the team is one of, if not the best player on the team? Because, like, Al Horford's, I think, a good leader, but he's not going to be the best player on the Celtics. Like, that's a part of the equation.
I think people try to make the best player the leader. But
right.
that's not always the case. Right now, to me, Al Horford is a better leader. Look at the teams he's been on.
Sure.
All right? He's been in championship contention, won championships in college. The way they played, the reason they played last year, had a lot to do with him.
Yep.
And he didn't have to get credit, because a lot of times when you're doing stuff like this and you're saying stuff like this, the reason why you're putting it out there is so if it turns around, you get credit for it. LeBron did a lot of things behind the scenes in Cleveland he didn't want to get credit for, because that's what leaders do. So for me, I still need to see a lot more in Kyrie Irving. And what if Kyrie's not a Celtic long term? What kind of leadership is that showing? Because if the team feels like he's not fully committed, maybe these young guys see through all that already.
Certainly a great first step if he is going to do something to, A, do it, and, B, talk about it. But just a quick question about the team itself before we move on. It seems like Kyrie's biggest issue with the team is experience. He talks about that. Is experience the one thing that you think is holding this team back?
No.
When you didn't think this team would be, is it because of experience?
No. It's not because of experience. It's because I don't think the pieces all fit together exactly right. I think that you've got a more talented unit than last year. But last year, they were up 3-2 in the Eastern Conference Finals. Does anyone right now, do we really think they're going to be in that same position again this year? Do we think this team is better positioned than last year? Now, part of my skepticism was I didn't think they were getting back two All-Stars, because I didn't know who Gordon Hayward was going to be. That's been proven out to be true. I hope Gordon Hayward gets it back at some point, but it doesn't look like that will be this right. year. The other part of it was Jason Tatum got the star treatment and earned it with his play. It is hard for a guy drafted as high as he was, who went to Duke, who all of a sudden is a rookie, is awesome in big moments, to now take not only a secondary role, a third or fourth role on the team. Not a lot of guys are equipped for that. So for all those reasons, and because I didn't know if Kyrie had never been the best player on a good team ever. Well, since high school. And even his high school teams actually weren't that good, because he went to some very small high school. He went to small mm-hmm. I think it was private school in Jersey. And so he didn't have the experience for it. And I just love the talent of some of the other teams. But this is, he had to do this at least privately. Publicly, I'm glad he did it, because I don't think it was looking for credit. Maybe it was partially, but I think it's almost a public mea culpa. He very publicly undercut LeBron with that interview with Stephen A. I think now this is a man, I got this part wrong.
I'm wait and see.
Okay.
I'm gonna wait and see. I've seen too many signs of other things to be. The biggest problem is not necessarily the leadership. The biggest problem in Boston is style. Brad Stevens' style does not match their best player, the most talented player that they have. They do not match. Brad Stevens is motion, it's get the ball, let everyone touch it, and no one is really the point guard in Brad Stevens' offense. We talk about his defense. We know they're great defensively. But offensively, Kyrie Irving and the way he wants to play does not fit the style that Brad Stevens coaches. That's the biggest problem in Boston. It's not leadership.
All right. Leave it there. Take a break. Coming up, is James Harden's incredible season being wasted? That's next on First Things First. Big night of college basketball comes your way tomorrow on FS1. Action from the Big Ten and the Big East. First, Maryland battles Ohio State at 6 Eastern. And then at 8:30, Xavier facing off with defending national champion Villanova. College basketball tomorrow on FS1 and the Fox Sports app.
Let's go. go, Jay Wright.
Back here, first things first, we're going viral. Amari Cooper was traded to the Cowboys in October, and that acquisition changed the Cowboys' season. He's expected to get a big extension this offseason to remain with the team, and he's already anticipating his payday. Take a look at this chain he bought. So TMZ Sports said the chain is worth $65,000.
It's a nice little medallion. Diamonds hold their value pretty well.
But, like, what kind of event are you going to wear that chain to? Is that an everyday? Like, I had to run to CVS to get something.
It's not every day, but he's going to be going places that he would need a piece like that. Not necessarily yourself and everything, but game day. You go to certain events in the off season. Yeah. Being a young person, he's from Miami. Guys from Miami like diamonds, like flashy stuff. So, that's good not the Amari Cooper that I knew.
I was just going to say,
that's not the Amari Cooper. Now, he's not on the road to being Antonio Brown, but treat yourself.
It's much like the Michael Thomas with a little surprise. You saw him do the cell phone celebration. Fame and wealth is intoxicating a bit. Amari Cooper came a long way from working out in a hoodie for Nick Saban trying to get a scholarship offer.
No problem. Yeah, he's probably going to get about $60 million this offseason, at least, from the Cowboys.
So if he gets $65 million, then that was 1/1,000th of what he's going to get from the Cowboys. So he got it. Good for you, Amari Cooper.
I'm okay with it. I just want to know where he was wearing it.
I don't think he'll be wearing it back where I used to visit him.
No. If he is, he's going to tuck it in. Like when Debo comes around on Friday. Tuck it in.
And crazy glue it to his chest. Time for stories to start your morning. We start with some unexpected news out of college football. Alabama quarterback Jalen Hurts has transferred to Oklahoma. Hurts, who lost his starting job to Tua Tagovailoa, will be under the guidance of Lincoln Riley, whose quarterbacks have won two straight Heismans. See, what do you make of Hurts' decision?
I'm happy for Jalen Hurts. I believe he is going to grow as a quarterback there under Lincoln Riley. But I believe this is one of the biggest moves in college football because right now we have some changing of the guards. We had Clemson upset Alabama. We know they have Tua coming back for Alabama. But Dabo Sweeney right now, man, they have to be dealt with if you're in college football. What if Lincoln Riley turns this quarterback into a pro prospect? Then all the high school kids out there, they need to be put on notice. You must go see Lincoln Riley. And also, NFL, the NFL's not done with Lincoln Riley. Based on all the new coaches and the offensive philosophy, this is a big move for Oklahoma and Lincoln Riley's future.
And I want to give Jalen credit because he made, I think, the best decision for his football career. Not only was the University of Miami recruiting him heavy, my source down at Live in Miami.
Oh, yeah, he was up in there popping bottles.
Well, except he never had a drink.
No, he had a Shirley Temple.
Exactly right, but they did the whole presentation for him. If he wanted to go live in Miami, have that life, he could have. Instead, he goes to Norman, Oklahoma to try to further his
I should have sent some of my old Hurricane buddies. They would have got him signed.
Okay. I am happy for Jalen Hurts. Good luck to the young
man. Yeah. Shirley Temple.
Mm-hmm. Virgin Shirley Temple. Let's just go with that, see? Go ahead.
Shirley Temple is a virgin Shirley Temple.
I understand, Jenna.
To the NBA, LeBron James has been cleared to return to practice next week as he recovers from his groin injury. But his agent, Rich Paul, said that LeBron is on nobody else's timeline. Nick, what is he referring to here? What do you make of Rich Paul's comments?
He means, listen, they know what we know, which is the Lakers about to lose their next three games. Oklahoma City, Houston, Golden State, they're going to lose them. And they are not going to rush LeBron back based on where the Lakers are in the standings. When you have a player who's played 16 years without an injury and then suffers a real injury, what you are not going to do is change the recovery timeline based on anything other than to make sure he doesn't suffer another injury.
Well, they were hoping at the beginning, Jenna, that he might miss a game or two. Then after that, after seeing that MRI, they realized there was a serious tear there. Then they were on the Steph Curry timeline because Steph had a serious groin injury. How many games did he miss, Nick?
11.
They were like, oh, LeBron, he's the fastest healer ever. Then when you got past that Steph threshold, it's like, listen, we're in new territory.
Yeah.
All right? This is a serious injury, and that's why they're really – LeBron's not even running up and down the court yet.
No.
They had him shooting them jump shots, but he was stationary. He wasn't lifting off. You know the reason why? Because that injury has still yet to fully heal. He's not going up and down the court. You can't play an NBA game unless you go up and down the court.
Uncharted waters for LeBron James. The Warriors won again last night. They beat the Pelicans 147-140. Steph Curry – not bad. 41 points, 9 three-pointers. Oh, and Boogie comes back tomorrow. After the game, Draymond Green said, quote, all hell's about to break loose. Nick, I ask you, is all hell about to break loose?
Absolutely, one way or the other. I'd say the 90% likelihood is the way Draymond means it, which is the Warriors about to go on a crazy tear. The 10% likelihood is that this thing, while they're playing their best basketball of the year, is about to be disrupted by Boogie. Boogie had a very interesting interview where he said, I am more stubborn and hard-headed now than ever. Now, he says that publicly, so he obviously doesn't think that's going to be a problem. I don't think it's going to be a problem. I think the Warriors are about to get even better, but Draymond's going to be proven right one way or the other.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching Boogie play. He's got a good story. He needs to be able to resurrect his career after a horrific Achilles injury, after having his best season. Last season, let's not forget, he played the best basketball he's ever played on the best team that he's ever been on. Let's see if he's playing on the greatest team that we've ever seen. See if his attitude is a little bit different.
All right, moving on. The Rockets fell to the Nets last night. Yes, you heard that correct. 145-142, despite a season-high 58 points from James Harden. You also heard that correct. That broke Harden's previous season-high set last game when he scored 57. Harden called the loss very frustrating, putting it mildly. Nick, what do you make of Harden's performance in this loss?
Listen, I know the Rockets care that they lost. I don't. What's happening with James Harden is absolutely unprecedented. There's two record books in NBA history. There's the Wilt record book, and there's everybody else. So let's just remove the Wilt part of the record book, because Wilt averaged 40 points for 515 consecutive games. No one else did it for more than 40. Harden's now done it for 20, puts him in the top five all time.
You say 500?
515 consecutive games averaging 40 points. Harden becomes the first player since Wilt to hit 55 points in consecutive games. He has scored, 115 points in his last two games. Zero of those points have been assisted. So not only is he scoring at an unprecedented rate, he's doing it in the hardest way imaginable. No alley-oops from a teammate, no cutting to the basket easy layup, no spotting up on the three-point line, someone driving kicks. No, it's a lot of this. Dribble, 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 exhaust yourself and still score. It's troubling for the Rockets, of course, that he did this and they lost. They blew two leads late in the game, one with 90 seconds in regulation, one with 90 seconds in overtime. But he scored 58, and it wasn't even considered to lead the television show because it's like, oh, yeah, Harden's doing it again. I'm running out of words to describe what he's doing, Chris.
Yeah, what he's doing is very, very special. But I think first of all, shout out to the Brooklyn Nets for getting the win. They're still in playoff contention.
They got 15-5 since
they got a very good product that they're putting out there. Spencer Dinwiddie sat here on the show last week. He pours in 31. Big night for him. But James Harden, there's two things. He's playing great basketball. I didn't see Wilt play. But this is the easiest time to score the basketball in the NBA than any other time. There is no defense. It's like going to LA Fitness and playing basketball. Like, the guys don't care about defense, so I haven't seen anything like it in my lifetime. And I believe that this will affect their overall play. He's already been an MVP. They haven't had any playoff success with James Harden, and that's what really this season is about, or his tenure there in Houston is about. And I just believe he's going to wear himself out with that usage that you're talking about. It is hard to score like that, and they didn't win the game. That's the most important thing out there. So he is playing special, but they are shorthanded, and I just believe in the playoffs, he's going to lose his legs. When you lose your legs, you lose your jump shot.
And he that is absolutely on the board, but if he wasn't playing at this pace for the last 20 games, they weren't going to make the playoffs. Like, with Chris Paul hurt, right, now with Capella hurt, they need every ounce of this from him just to make the playoffs in the West. And Chris is right. This year in the NBA is a lot like this year in the NFL. Unprecedented, or at least contemporary in the league history.
But there ain't no weather coming in November or December. Well, we saw a correction in the NFL.
Correct. And I think there'll be a mild correction in the playoffs, but it's because of the rule change, the freedom of movement. But with that said, it's not like there's a bunch of guys averaging 35 a game. So even with
every night somebody in the NBA getting 40. There's been no night that I, no time that I've ever covered the NBA that was like that. Oh, we didn't even mention Steph 41.
Steph had 41. 100% agreed, but he is still, even with the enhanced offense, he's doing it at a higher level than anyone by a wide margin right now.
All right, let's get back to the NFL now. Rams at New Orleans. Rams had a great game plan to beat the Cowboys last week. Remember, run and then run and then keep running to the tune of 273 yards. But a lot of focus will be now on how Jared Goff matches up against the Saints defense. And when you ask his opposing quarterback, Drew Brees, he, not surprisingly, has nothing but praise for Goff.
He's tremendous. There's not many guys that are just better, you know, pure passers, throwers. You know, you watch what they do with their offense. There's a lot of moving parts, and I think he handles it very, very well. I think he creates great timing and rhythm in the passing game, and obviously he had a phenomenal season last year, but he's had an even better season this year. The future is really bright for him.
All right, CeCe, you saw what the Rams did last week and what they're very good at doing, especially since CJ has come along. But if this game turns into a shootout, can the Rams keep pace with the Saints?
I do believe that they can. And the reason why is because the weakest part of the Saints team happens to be their secondary. And their secondary, it comes and goes, quarter to quarter, series to series. And a lot of that is dependent upon Eli Apple. Can he hold down one of those corner spots opposite of Marshawn Lattimore, who is back to playing spectacular football? And, yeah, and I do believe with Cooks as a receiver, Robert Woods, I believe, is one of the most underrated wide receivers that we have. He blocks, he runs routes, he runs reverses. He is a guy that I believe could have a huge impact in this game because they'll be terrified of Cook's speed. And they will give him a lot of room because they drafted him. He had success there. But I do believe that the Rams definitely in a shootout. And I'm one of the people that is a fan of Jared Goff. I believe he's a very good thrower of the football. If you watch the type of throws that he makes and how he understands football, now I do believe as he gets older in the league and he gets more seasoned, he's not a really big guy, he'll become a little more receptive in the pocket. He'll be able to throw against pressure a little bit better. And there's not a lot of guys that come into the league that have that veteran toughness in the pocket. That part is developed over a long a period of time. And I see what Drew Brees sees. I see a guy that makes pinpoint throws. I see a guy who understands football, distributes the football around. And we know that he has Sean McVay going to assist him in his learning. So he's only going to get better.
I think the Rams would prefer to be in a shootout than a defensive struggle. I think the Rams, I think the Saints are better. I think the Saints should win this game. But I don't think anyone should be shocked at all if the Rams win. And can the Rams win a game 42-38? Absolutely. It's the Rams' offense that over the last couple months of the season, except for a two-game stretch against the Bears and Eagles, that has been on fire, and the Saints' offense that's been more hit and miss. The Saints score, here's their scoring output over the last 6 weeks, 10, 28, 12, 31, 14, 20. The Rams dating back to the Saints game, 35, 36, 51, 30, 6 against the Bears, 23 against the Eagles, 31, 48, 30. Like, the Rams are absolutely prepared and equipped for a back-and-forth football game. We saw them play Kansas City like that.
Now, one thing that I do want to watch, and I think that it's a good observation for fans, week number 17, if you look at all the four teams that we have left, the Saints were the only team that did not play most of their starters. Yep. So I believe that that led to them getting off to a slow start compared to the other teams. Kansas City, fast start. New England, red hot. Rams against Dallas, red hot starting. But because you didn't play and you had those other 4 weeks in there where they didn't play great football, you put that in there on top of the bye week, I think it led to that lull that they had the first quarter and a half against Philly. But after that, they outscored Philly 20-0.
And they outgained them 399-97. The Saints, I 100% agree. I think it's an overlooked point that the Saints clearly were rusty in that first quarter against Philly. Philly was red hot and feeling great. Mm-hmm. They got the extra juice of the first play of the game is a Drew Brees pick.
Yes.
All of that. But it was from the second quarter on, it was total domination by the Saints. You don't usually see that in a game that's 20-14 with the Eagles driving potentially for the win. So I think the Saints can win any type of game.
I think the Rams are less likely to win a 21-17 game than they are a 41-38 game. That's the point I'm making. Mm-hmm. I think the Saints are more equipped to win a low-scoring game than the Rams are.
Let's talk about a game plan just for a second, because we saw last week they ran the ball 48 times. They passed, I think, 28 times. That was the breakdown. Do you see something similar? Last week they used Goff a little more in a game manager role.
Yes.
What do you see this week for the Rams?
Well, let's just go inside the Saints locker room. Let's go on Dennis Allen. He's the defensive coordinator. You're watching all this film. You see C.J. Anderson. He's not new. Todd Gurley might be the best running back. So, you know, as a game plan standpoint, you look at that film of Dallas, you're like, wow, Dallas had people committed to the run and they still ran it. There's no way you don't look at that film and think that they're not going into the Superdome and run the football. So if I'm the Rams, I know what they're thinking. I'm going play action pass early in the game to generate some big plays and to take that crowd out of the game. I know they're going to have 7 in the box. I know they're going to have 8 in the box. So how do I generate big plays? I know what they're going to do. I know what they've studied. They'd be crazy not to have that many people committed to the box. So how do I get this young quarterback started? How do I get this crowd down? I'm going to make some big plays through the passing game, utilize my speed, and let's get it started that way.
What Chris is talking about, Jen, I'm going to use a reference you'll like, even though it's one Chris probably
Seinfeld?
Won't. No, it's a Princess Bride situation. Oh. I know what you know, what I know. And
yeah.
So everyone knows the Rams, the Saints don't have Sheldon Rankins. The Rams are running the ball at an unbelievable clip. They have Todd Gurley and CJ's averaging 140 a game in the last 3 weeks. Of course they're going to run the ball. So use your most valuable weapon on offense, which is your play action pass, where they ran 51% of their pass plays last week in play action. They were their most efficient in the pass game all year in play action. Use what they think they know about you against them.
That. Yeah. And then you tell me which one you want to drink, Nick.
That's the Princess Bride reference.
Coming up, are the Patriots allowed to play the underdog roles? That's next on First Things First. Back here, First Things First, we welcome in former NFL head coach, Eric Mangini. You said you wanted a great introduction. That was my number 79 in your playbooks, number 1 in your hearts. It's
what?
Eric Mangini.
I still want one. We've got another segment.
They're all laughing in my ear. That was the first time you made the control room laugh.
It's good to
game
start.
Jersey. Yeah.
Game jersey, mm-hmm. Game face. We are quickly approaching, we'll explain to you in the break.
Thank you.
Maybe you already know. Championship Sunday, and for the Patriots, this will feel different. Not the game, but the odds. Patriots at Arrowhead to face the Chiefs. Get this, Pats will be playoff underdogs for the first time since the 2013 AFC Championship game. Woo, break out those underdog masks. Julian Edelman is certainly embracing the underdog role, tweeting out a hype video with the hashtag #BetAgainstUs. Well, here's what Brady had to say on not being favored on Sunday.
Doesn't change much for us, but it just, you know, shows you kind of what, you know, people would think about, you know, what our chances are. That's about it.
Doesn't.
No more added comment to that.
Coach, it feels like you'd have to squint and just barely make something out to see the Patriots as underdogs in any playoff game. That's just the way it feels.
Not at this desk. I mean, I've been sitting here all season with the champion of the Kansas City Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes. They're an extreme underdog in your eyes, I'm
Melody,
sure, right?
Don't get on the plane, Coach.
They're playing on the road. They're playing Patrick Mahomes. They're playing that vaunted Chiefs offense. I mean, you probably are betting everything you have on
well,
this game.
Well, you are encouraging me to bet.
Yeah, you
told me to put my money where
based
my mouth is.
Based off of how strongly you feel about this team, I push it all
push
in.
Push it all in.
That's what I'm saying, push it all in.
All right, so we don't have to rehash the who ended up if we want to revisit all our Patrick Mahomes discussions. Who
no,
ended up
we
looking
should
better.
Because that's why they're underdogs.
Okay, well, they're underdogs because they're on the road. They're
true.
Underdogs because they had a worse record.
True.
They're underdogs because, by most metrics, they are the slightly inferior team. Like, that's why. They're underdogs because in the last 10 combined AFC and NFC championship games, the home team is 10-0. Like, the Patriots should be just about 3-point underdogs, and they are just about 3-point underdogs. I find it a little rich
that the New England Patriots, who have been favored leading into this week in 67 consecutive games quarterbacked by Tom Brady and have been underdogs in the playoffs once in the last 11 years, that they're playing the nobody believes in us card. But when for the better part of a decade, everyone has always believed in you, and now there are some people who have the gall to say, you know what, I think the 12-4 team at home is going to beat the 11-5 team on the road. This is the closest. They haven't been able to play this card, see, in 15 years, 16 years. They can now at least credibly a little bit play it, and Brady started it walking off the field. I know we suck and we can't win any games. We'll see. And now Julian Edelman is following in his footsteps.
It will always be a constant theme for Tom Brady based on didn't have a great college career, got benched for another player. Coach liked another guy more than him. Edelman was a quarterback at Kent State, has developed himself into a pro, one of the best slot receivers on his own. Him and Brady. Those two, there's no two closer on New England's team than Brady and Edelman. So, yes, they do have that underdog feel. They utilize it all the time. Now, as a team, the Patriots, no, they're not able to utilize it, but it's one of the low-hanging fruits for NFL, pro sports, high school, old people disrespect you. Rodney Dangerfield, all they don't have respect. Whatever you need to do to be able to get motivated, I know going on to the field, the Patriots will be thinking about this. If we don't play our best football, we will not win. If we don't play better than we've played on the road in our previous 8 road games, and especially that one in Miami that we saw late in the season where they lost the game in a totally not of the Patriot way, where they don't have the right personnel on the field. They got one guy to get tackled to end the game, and they got Rob Gronkowski chasing after a guy that I know if they could be put back in that situation, Gronk wouldn't be the guy chasing them to put him on the ground.
And by the way, if they win that game, this game's in Gillette. I know we joke a bit, but do you think I was or have been overreacting to the idea that this Pats team, of the Pats teams we've seen that have made 8 consecutive AFC championship games, this Pats team seems the weakest of the bunch? It's not just because they have the worst record of the bunch, the first one to lose 5 games, but because of their inability to win consistently on the road, the blowout losses on the road, the lack of real weaponry in the wide receiving core. Do you think that's been unfair of me to say now it's comparing them against some great, great teams, but that this is the weakest Patriot team we've seen in the 2010s?
I feel like every year we go into the season and people talk about how it's the weakest Patriots team, or how Tom Brady is too old, he's all done. And remember with Jimmy Garoppolo, I think I was doing the herd, and Colin was talking about, well, you know, Garoppolo should be in there after Tom had like 1 or 2 bad games. Mm-hmm. They wanted to move on from him at that point. You know, and as you look throughout the course of the season, whether it's Josh Gordon, who's there and now he's gone, and the receiving core isn't what it was supposed to be. Like, I get why they view themselves as the underdog, and there's been a lot of people who've talked about their demise and how they shouldn't be where they are. So it makes sense why they're taking that
approach. Why do you think they're underdogs in this game? Forget being on the road.
Well, I do think that the matchup against this offense for anybody is incredibly challenging.
Yes.
You saw what Patrick Mahomes did in the second half of the game in Gillette. He made one mistake in the first half that really hurt the team, and hopefully he's learned from that. And they're explosive. They're explosive, and defensively, Kansas City is playing better. And New England hasn't played as well on the road as they have at home. So all those things come into play. And look, I think you should bet the gold chain that you have around your neck.
And it's whatever, a diamond chain, Coach.
And whatever other cash and put
okay,
it in.
Well, all right, you worry about my personal finances at another day.
Well, I'm trying to help you.
Okay, I do remember us sitting here, and I was very surprised to hear it from you the day after that Pats Chiefs game. And you said, if they play again, if they play in the playoffs in Kansas City, that Chiefs team can beat the Pats team and you think would be favored to beat that Pats team. We are now getting that game, and that has been proven out to be true because you saw things in that game that made you more encouraged about Kansas City, a team we didn't know exactly who they were yet because it was so early in the season, than necessarily about New England, even though New England hung 43 on them and got the win.
I was very impressed with how New England was able with the red zone defense to slow them down early. But then after that, it was just they just ran out of time. I mean, for them to be able to come back and have the lead late in the fourth quarter in that game, yes, it took him because I know Belichick, he don't have an answer for that speed. I know the things that hurt the principles of that defense. And if Kansas City can run the football, it will terrify them because they are already committed to a certain number of people to coverage. All right? I'm not going to rush the passer. If I'm the Kelce side, I'm going to jam him. If Kelce's all the way outside the numbers, they had Hightower all the way outside the cavity of the defense to be able to jam him and then get back into coverage. Those types of things Bill Belichick hates to do, and they are facing that. And that quarterback, it's not the formations. That quarterback's ability to be able to make plays with his arms and ultimately with his legs, I believe that's how Kansas City has the edge. Kansas City should be the favorite. They're very, very talented. And some of the things that they do, they really hurt the principles of what New England would like to do.
All right, Coach, stick around. Got to take a break. Coming up, which Hall of Famer is comparing Nick Foles to Tom Brady?
It's not me.
The answer next on First Things
Not me.
Back here with Eric Mangini. Time for your Subway Choice moment. Coach, there are four quarterbacks left in the playoff field, and Nick Foles isn't one of them. That's not the news. The news is his future. Right now, it's unclear whether the Eagles will keep him. Move that would cost the team $20 million. According to Hall of Famer Brett Favre, whoever gets Foles is getting something special.
No disrespect at all to Carson Wentz. I think he's already proven that he is a great quarterback. Totally different than Nick Foles. Nick Foles, to me, is more of a Brady-esque type quarterback. You know, very, very limited in what he can do, but very, very good in what he does. I mean, he's a pure pocket passer, and he's great at dishing it out, and he's proven that he's clutch. You know, and he did it this past week. He did it last year. He's done it time and time again. And he's proven that he can win the big games. And so that, I think, was what we have to look at, or the Eagles or anyone in a similar situation. You have to look at, you know, it's about winning. It's about being clutch, doing really what you expect your players to do. And he does it as well as anyone.
All right, Coach, what do you think about what Brett Favre said? Is Nick Foles a proven starter?
Well, I do agree in terms of the comparison he's making, Brady-esque, as not a necessarily mobile guy, a pure pocket passer. I think that's where he was going with that. In terms of him being a starter, it's so hard to say because you look at his body of work, he's never started a full season. And even after he had his big year in Philadelphia where he threw 27 touchdowns and two interceptions, they traded him. They traded him to the Rams to get Sam Bradford, and they gave up a two and a four and got
it was weird. There was a three back. It was quarterbacks and draft.
But they wanted to move on from, okay, so maybe they made a mistake at that point. But he goes to St. Louis at the time, and he doesn't do very well in St. Louis. And then he ends up going to Kansas City with Andy Reid, who drafted him, and Andy was willing to move on from him. So you look at it, there's enough coaches in that mix. There's enough systems in that mix. Why do we have this disconnect that we have? And can you count on him to play 16 games? And is he at his best as a reliever as opposed to a full-time starter? And how do you say it? Because he's never done it. So you're betting on the guy that you've seen over this last period of time that you can project that out over 16 games in the playoffs.
Listen, I think Nick Foles should be a starter in this league, but I would be very, it's a very specific type of team that I think is going to get the most out of Nick Foles. To me, Nick Foles' biggest attribute right now is he's one of, and there's not a long list of quarterbacks like this, that we know through multiple playoff game experience, the moment won't be too big for him.
that we know beyond a shadow of a doubt, like the question that you have about Carson Wentz, like, or about, and that's not a knock on Wentz.
But then he's got to go to a team that's going to make the playoffs.
Well, so that's the thing, that you have this question about literally any quarterback that hasn't played in the playoffs, right? No matter how good they look, what will they look like in the biggest moments? We know the moment won't be too big for Nick Foles, but I don't think he's a force multiplier, to use your term, that's going to take a team that is a below average team and get them to the playoffs. So you have to find this like Goldilocks zone of team that needs, that is good enough to make the playoffs with average quarterback play, that needs a quarterback that can say we want it. Like, I think Denver makes sense for instance, because I still think they have a good defense. I like what they're able to do. I like the coach they hired. I think they should be able to compete for a wild card spot. And we know if they get there, the moment's not too big for them. But like a rebuilding team like Miami, I think his skills would be wasted because I don't think he's good enough to make Miami much better. And if his whole utility is, if we get to the big games, he's been there, done that. What good does that do if your team's 6-10?
But what are the chances he's going to get placed in a situation that A, pays him, B, is ideal, C, that the Eagles don't pick up his option? It just seems like so many things have to happen for him to be in the ideal situation where he can play his best football.
Not unless he's able to get to Jacksonville and that defense. They go out back to the type of season they had two seasons ago or three seasons ago. Compared to that, they got someone there in John DeFilippo who is familiar with his skill set, because I've been in too many locker rooms, and there's a lot of guys, man, that like to be that relief pitcher. And they are so comfortable, that day-to-day pressure, they don't have to deal with it. All that media, they don't have to deal with it. They don't have to be the big man on campus in front of the locker room with the other guys. They don't have to practice to a high, high standard every day. There are guys that thrive at that. And to me, that's what Nick Foles has done. The best thing for Nick Foles is staying in Philadelphia behind Carson Wentz. But if he wants to be a starter, to me, he's played well. If Case Keenum is a starter, he should be a starter. All right? Because he is a better version of Case Keenum. That's probably the reason why you have him going to Denver.
Yes.
But
I don't have him going to Denver. But, I just mean that type of team.
It's a proper placement, right? Because he's better than the guy there. To me, I still worry. Brett Favre, what got Brett Favre out of Green Bay? It wasn't his ability to play. It was that the guy behind him has a higher ceiling. And that's what you have with Carson Wentz and Nick Foles. To me, Nick Foles will never be better than he is right now. Don't fool yourself. And if you think that he can take over a franchise and lead them, he's a force multiplier, I think that you're missing on it and you're just caught up in the moment. Because I watched Nick Foles play his whole career, but I also watched the last three quarters of that Saints game, and he was everything but a force multiplier. He did not make big throws. He did not make great decisions. He was not that type of leader. When he was going against Drew Brees, the score ended up being 20-0 after that first quarter. So don't get caught up in the hype. Look at it, and I've been with guys that they were better sitting in the back seat or being in the passenger seat than actually driving the car, Coach.
Yeah, it's a little bit like runners. Some people are built for marathons, and some people are sprinters, and that's just what they're good at. I would be interested to see him go to, like, the Giants, where it's a West Coast offense, and it's a system that he's thrived in. He mm-hmm. needs to go to the system that he's been good at as well. And I think that was one of the problems in St. Louis, is he went from a system that he was very effective in to a system that he wasn't very effective in. So that system fit is important. You could see him in Washington. They, you know, with Alex Smith and Colt McCoy, they have a real issue there. It's a coaching staff that needs to probably bring in a veteran guy. And
I think you like the intel that he has against that NFC East.
He's competed in this division and done well in this division. So those are two spots I could see that make sense for especially the Giants from a scheme perspective to stay in the West Coast.
The Giants were the team that I was, when we circle back around, going to come to if the Giants aren't going to draft Haskins or a different young quarterback at number 6. If the Giants aren't going to do that, because I do think they have excellent offensive talent, they need, and if they want to use that 6th overall pick on either an offensive or defensive lineman and try to do what Dave Gettleman tried to do last year, which is win right now, what I know Pat Shurmur would like to do, which is win right now, but also move on from Eli, I think that is the type of team I'm talking about, a team that you think credibly, oh, that could be a 10-win team next year.
And then when you look at it, how do you choose him over Flacco? I mean, you got Flacco's going to be on the market too, looking at two guys that have won.
Yep.
How do you make that decision?
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.